Okay, another question from the audience. And again, we will stay on the air until 8 o'clock, at which point we will leave the air and go back to great music on KPCW with volunteer DJs. But we will remain here for those in the Santee to answer your questions beyond that time. Go ahead.
So I have a question as a soon-to-be physical therapist. If the ACA is funded by these, quote, cuts, I mean $415 billion in Medicare and Medicaid cuts, and those programs tend to set the standard for reimbursement, what does that mean for reimbursement for healthcare providers?
Go ahead, Rob. Why don't you start off there, since your bills can be rather large.
Hospitals are expensive places, no question about that. I read an article here recently that was put together based on an interview of one of the leaders at the Cleveland Clinic. Cleveland Clinic is a large, nationally known provider of healthcare services, of course, based in Cleveland. And they spend about $6 billion a year to operate this very large healthcare system. They're projecting that the impacts of this change over the next few years, the $627 billion that's going to come out of the provider payments, is going to require them to reduce their cost of operations to $4.4 billion in the next 5 years. And they have announced this year publicly that they will be reducing $300 million, so that's on track with these projections out of this article. The concern of that is, as you try and shrink that down, is can we effectively reposition healthcare, give better care on the front end, keep people out of the more expensive levels of care, and in essence provide better outcomes for less cost. But the reality impact of that as well, as you said you were a student, as of now, and is that 55% of the cost to operate hospitals is salary and wages and benefits. It's very labor intense, and so there is going to be impact. We're seeing across the country numbers of layoffs. I've heard speakers for the last couple of years talk about hospitals needing to reduce their expenses anywhere from 17 to 30% to get through that. And even at that, 25% of hospitals in the country will struggle financially with 40% of those 25 or 10% of the hospitals across the country likely going to close as a result of the impacts of this and the repositioning. I don't know if those numbers are right or not. There's a lot of projections in there. But there is a clear reality that our world is going to change. I hope that it changes in a way that focuses care in the right location for our patients, that engages the providers of care, the hospitals, the physicians, and the patients together in making better decisions and making right decisions. We started by talking in one of the early questions about patients going to the ER for care when they could get care in a much less costly setting. That's a large issue, and there's lots of other large issues in healthcare. And we're going to have to, over the next few years, figure this out. And one of the things that the ACA does, the law, is forces us to start to figure this out and figure it out quickly. And in that process, there will be winners and losers, so to speak, those who succeed and those who fail. My hope, again, is that in the end we'll get a better healthcare system from the efforts to change.
And Dr. Lechman, there's a lot of concern among physicians that cuts come out of them and talk that doctors will start some refusing insurance and take only high-end patients. And on top of that, aren't we facing a doctor shortage here in the next 10, 12 years? The projections I saw are a deficit of 90,000 doctors by 2020. So how does ACA impact those who have to look at the business side of their practice?
Well, you've just touched on three of the things that keep me awake at night. One of the things, first of all, we can talk about the shortage of physicians. And one of the reasons that we have a shortage is because for probably the last, 20, 30 years or so, it has made more sense to physicians to become a secondary care doctor, a proceduralist, because those are the folks who make more money. And at a time when debts from going to medical school are significant, or from going to college are significant, you want to be able to pay those off. And so we have this imbalance, really, where more people are interested in going into procedural areas than in primary care. But the future really is, in terms of providing good health care, it is in primary care. our primary care physicians need to really be able to have an excellent relationship with patients so that they can give them good guidance, so that they understand all of their problems. And so you don't have someone going from specialist to specialist when what they really needed was someone to understand everything going on in their life. So one of the things that is in the Affordable Care Act increases for primary care, and those have been happening over the last few years. But those increases still do not bring primary care close to what secondary care is. Now, the other thing that's in play is the fact that historically we've had a system where it's been what's called fee-for-service, meaning a physician gets paid for doing something, for seeing you, has to be in the office, for doing an appendectomy, for whatever. They don't get paid for talking to you on the telephone. They don't get paid for responding to an email that you might send. And if we're serious about getting the cost of health care under control, and I'll tell you, I mean, that's the focus of the organization that I work for and of myself in terms of working with the physicians that I work for, then we have to find a better way to pay people, to pay physicians, so that they are paid for keeping people healthy, for helping them manage their disease, rather than getting paid when they're sick. And when you have a responsibility, as I do, for a sizable number of both primary care and secondary care, figuring out how to come up with that compensation system, it's very, very difficult. But in terms of the health of our economy and of healthcare itself, we're going to have to figure that out.
Any addition? Go ahead, Jason. Actually,
although we do definitely face a primary care doctor shortage, one thing that's going to help is that we are going to have a lot more mid-level providers entering the system, physicians' assistants and nurse practitioners. And, in fact, there was a recent health affairs study that said there's going to be a surplus. I think it was 45,000 physicians' assistants over the next 10 years. And really what it requires is medical providers working to the top level of their training. And if primary care doctors can work on things that are a little bit more complicated and really delve into their medical training, and physicians' assistants and nurse practitioners can work on things that are the top level of their training, then we have a healthcare system that I think is going to be more efficient. My wife is a family doctor in Salt Lake City, and she sort of sees this already happening within our healthcare system, and I think that's going to continue as more people enter the mid-level professions. And we have some really good mid-level PA and nurse practitioner schools here in Utah.
Okay, any other comment on that? No? Come on up with your question, and let me remind you that you can tweet us at hashtag PCHealth or email a question to info@kpcw.org, and go ahead with your question.
Thanks, Larry. I may need to just have a personal conversation with Greg Mattis after this, but I'm here representing a small employer that has less than 50 employees, and the person that actually should be here had another engagement, and so I told her I would pass on the questions. We actually, the employer actually uses Intermountain Select Health Med Plus as their is the product that they offer the employees at their business. And we sat down with a broker that works with us that shops, and he has like 99 different plans that he can do, and maybe it isn't 99 based on what you said, that there's 60 plans in Summit County, but I think they do 99 plans for, you know, more than just Summit County. They have other employers that they represent. Anyway, long story short, we sat down in October and November with them and kind of trying to figure out if it would be better for the employees to go after the subsidy, you know, that kind of thing that Jason outlined, and it was determined that it would be best to stay with a group plan for the employees. And we said, okay, then let's lock, and we were given the option with the Select Health Med Plus product to lock it so that on December 1 we would have the same coverage that the employees are enjoying this year. And we are now on our first appeal with the Intermountain Select Health Med Plus people saying that we missed the deadline, but what I think it was Jason said, it's December 23 is the deadline for December 1 coverage moving forward. And so I'm not understanding that. And then the price numbers that you put up there for out-of-pocket and for deductibles are way different numbers than what we're being quoted. And the employees are trying to understand what is really what they need to do, how much do they need to put aside in their S-125 accounts to cover their out-of-pocket. And last but not least, two more things. The new, I don't know if it's a, if it's just something that the Intermountain Select Health Med Plus decided to do, or if it's part of the Affordable Care Act, but ADHD is not covered now in the plan, and it's like I think the number one diagnosis of every child in this state, and so it's a tough one to not be covered. And then the other thing is that the Intermountain took out the supplemental accident coverage, which was huge because it helped all the employees that they pretty much it's a very young workforce and they have young children. And so if you have a kid that, you know, does something where they cut their hand and they have to go to the ER to get stitches, right now the way it's set up, if they have to pay $500 and then the $250, you know, ER, it's very expensive for these employees.
Let's answer it.
So I think it's mainly
It's kind of a specific question about a specific company, but let's try to hit the high points quickly.
Sure. So definitely I will be happy to talk to you afterwards because there's a lot going on there. But one of the things going on, and this exemplifies how difficult this landscape is what it sounds like, and I need to talk to you more, but what it sounds like you and your broker were trying to do was what is called an early renewal, where you were locking in your 2013 coverage by renewing effective December 1st.
Correct.
And by doing that, you're actually keeping your 2013 coverage, which explains why you weren't getting those lower deductibles. Those were 2014 coverage amounts. If you want that increased coverage and those reduced deductibles, that's ACA coverage, and what your company was trying to do was avoid the ACA marketplace by renewing early on December 1st.
Correct.
It's kind of a mixed bag here in terms of good news, bad news. If the bad news is you missed the deadline for doing that, I can talk to you about that. The good
but
news
with
that?
We didn't miss the deadline. We did it in October and November, but they couldn't give us the firm numbers because the federal government hadn't given the firm numbers.
Well, there might be good news on that, and that is – it might be a blessing that you missed that deadline because of the announcement from President Obama a couple of weeks ago, that if you like the health plan you have, you can keep it business. So that announcement says that you actually can renew if you have that health plan in place on October 1st of 2013, which you did.
Absolutely.
On your renewal, not an early renewal, on your normal renewal during 2014, you can renew and keep your 2013 coverage, no appeal necessary, and actually it will last longer than that December 1st renewal would have because Obama's changed the landscape. So let me talk to you, and again, very confusing,
Let's
but you
it.
Actually are in a good position to take advantage of this recent development. So talk to me after.
Thank you. And we have about 10 minutes left for the broadcast portion of the forum and some more social media questions submitted to Monica.
We actually have quite a few from email. This person asks, as a person with pre-existing conditions and who doesn't qualify for subsidies, is it better for me to go directly to insurance providers or do I have to go through the frustrating marketplace website? Will I be paying the same premiums with either of these options?
I can answer that. If you aren't eligible for subsidies, for instance, you make more than 400% of the federal poverty level, single or family, however it works out, what you would really could have that choice. You know, you wouldn't gain anything by going through the marketplace except that it's sort of a one-stop shop where you can compare all of the plans. Sort of like going to the cereal aisle of your grocery store, you have all the cereal boxes in front of you, as opposed to going to each aisle to hunt for one item here or there. So the advantage is in the shopping experience, not in any kind of affordability measure that you get, but you certainly would have the ability to go to any insurer, including insurance websites that offer sort of a broader scope like ehealthinsurance.com. So no advantage to the marketplace except convenience.
Okay, Ethel, a question from the audience.
Well, it's from social media.
Okay.
This question says, this person has an insurance policy that she likes, and she's worried that it may be canceled if it does not meet the new guidelines. And is there a time frame for insurance companies to drop coverage? If she continues with the one that she has, can they drop? Or how does she find out if it meets guidelines?
She probably would have already heard from her carrier if the coverage was not going to be continued in 2014. She probably should look for information from her carrier about how it may be changing, though. And there's a lot of confusion out there about what is a cancellation and what is not. Very few Utah policies are actually being canceled, with very rare exceptions. But many of the policies are changing as they get renewed in 2014 to comply with the provisions of the Affordable Care Act. And that gets back to this last issue we were just discussing, which is the late-breaking news in the last few weeks here is that permissive to each state, and Utah has not yet made a decision, and then permissive to the carriers who then can decide to do it or not, President Obama has allowed now, by executive fiat, carriers to renew those 2013 policies for another year. Now, at the end of that year, and this is the bad news, so that soundbite that was out there, you know, 3-4 years ago about if you like the coverage you have, you can keep it. It was, at best, an oversimplification then, mm-hmm. And it's not really going to be true long term. An announcement from a few weeks ago simply extends that another year, but eventually all of these policies in the individual and small employer marketplace are going to have to become ACA compliant. What that announcement does is it gives states the ability, if they decide to, and then carriers the ability after that to allow people one more year on that coverage. The good news for this person is if they haven't heard from their carrier, they're not having their coverage canceled as of January 1st. And that's very unlikely here in Utah, by the way.
Thank you.
Okay, and we'll go through the final deadlines as we conclude on what the new deadlines are. But another question from the audience now.
Thank you all for coming here tonight. It's a great discussion. There was an article in Time magazine by Stephen Brill called Bitter Pill about the egregious costs and of health care and how to basically reduce that.
It was the whole issue of the magazine was devoted to one story.
Well, there were varying levels to it, but Jason focused on one of them, which was the costs of devices, the costs of, you know, Robert, you're talking about the cost of labor in hospitals. Can you comment on the charge master and if we're really going to get into cost containment, what can we do between the Medicare costs and what they reimburse hospitals versus what the charge master charges insurance companies and what they pay?
And let's explain charge master quickly to Rob.
So the charge master is the list of prices a hospital uses. Having gone through the opening of a new hospital here 4 years ago in Park City, we got to set up a charge master from scratch. There's over 10,000 different charges in a charge master. I think there are two issues here as you look at this from the pricing perspective. One is, what is in that charge master? How is that developed over time versus what is then paid, as you noted, by the insurance companies? So every hospital, every provider, physicians included, negotiate with insurance companies for what they will accept for payment, and that's less. It's usually a discount off of that list price. There were a number of issues publicly a few years ago about that list price versus what people pay, and as a result of that, there was more standardization in approach across the country for people who don't have insurance. If you come to our hospital in Park City and you don't have coverage, you will get a discount to pay your bill if you come and work with us to do that. With that, the challenge on a charge master side is that you have all of these charges that come together. And we were talking with one of the attendees tonight before the meeting with when you come and want a service done at our hospital, what's that going to cost you? Well, I can give you a range and I can give you an average, but it's going to depend on what every one of those little items are that you use or don't use based on the judgment of your physician or what you choose or don't choose to have. And that is driven by regulation. So we have to, in the 60s, the Medicare program was set up, started to pay hospitals for care. In the 80s, that was changed from the list items plus a markup to a DRG, diagnostic-related group, that pays us a flat amount. But the regulation has gone on since then where we still have to create the bill with all of those little details on it. And that is a lot of cost. You want to talk about cost in the system that brings little value, there's one of them right there. And that then spills over into all the insurance billing processes and what has to go on those bills and played out. As we go forward, we will see, I think, a shift from this. When Dr. Lechman talked about the ACO, the Accountable Care Organization, the concept of spreading risk across the providers, and hopefully in some way across the patients too, so we're joined together in a partnership on how to deliver your care the most cost-effective way and the best way to get the best outcomes. When that happens, it shifts the risk from insurance companies to those providers. In that scenario, the charge master becomes somewhat irrelevant with that, because now the payment, the monthly insurance payment, goes to these providers, and we figure out how to do that all together in the best way to deliver your care to you. And it's not so much about what's billed on this fee-for-service world. So I'm hopeful that that will shift some of those dynamics. But those dynamics are driven right now heavily by the Medicare regulation, 60-plus thousand pages of regulations that hospitals have to operate under.
So is it moving towards a more outcomes-based reimbursement charging, like quality measurements? Those are actually going to be taking effect?
Those are taking effect now. Quality metrics and those things, as Dr. Lechman noted, for physicians is also happening on the hospital side. I see it going several steps beyond that, to where the hospitals and the doctors take on that risk to manage your care. And it's not so much about what's charged for the care, but what we're doing to help keep you healthy and then treat you when you're not healthy.
Dr. Lechman.
Just real quickly, one thing that I would add is that everyone who has high deductible health insurance should be very interested in that charge master and should be interested in having transparency of what costs are, so that if someone says that you need a CT scan, number one, you ask, do I really need that CT scan? And then secondly, what are the costs for where it might be obtained? And that's true for seeing a physician. It's true for any kind of a procedure. Transparency becomes very important when the patient or the health insurance member carries that responsibility for more of the cost.
Okay, final two questions from the audience we'll take, and we'll keep it here, studio. We will continue since we just have two final questions, so fire away.
This is email, and how does our new law compare to the programs in our familiar neighboring countries, such as Canada, UK, Australia, Germany, etc.? And don't we have some lessons to learn from these countries?
And this is what you hear over and over again, is that why is it so complicated and so expensive here? And who has the answer? Bill Barnes does.
Well, it doesn't compare much at all, in a sense. You hear a lot of talk about socialized medicine. Socialized, that term covers a lot of things. I mean, Canada, for example, the insurance is run by the government, but the hospitals and doctors are not employed by the government. England actually has maybe true socialized medicine. The insurance, the hospitals, and the doctors are all controlled by the government. European plans, they're all over the map. But the fact is, the United States is the only industrialized country that doesn't have some sort of universal health care. And this is a stab towards that. And it's interesting. I really think that the group that put this together, President Obama, Max Baucus, and others, really tried to do a bipartisan bill, because they didn't go the way of government control. They left it with private insurance companies. They left it, you know, the way it is. So, I mean, obviously that didn't work to get a bipartisan bill, but it's very different than our surrounding countries. This is, the United States is still pretty much free market, private insurance companies, private hospitals, private physicians. The only, quote, socialized system we have in this country is the Veterans Hospital System. So it's quite different.
Thank you.
Okay, one final question. This is KPCW Park City, and we'll keep it here because this is the final question for the KPCW and Intermountain Park City Medical Center Health Care Forum. One final question submitted by social media.
All right, we have a question. Can you please talk about what health care reform affects people who already have insurance, specifically in the way of premium increases, and how is it going to affect them who have a health savings account and high deductible plans?
Greg, you want to expound on that?
Sure. Many people, and this is one of the confusing things out there, many people who have insurance right now are confused by all the talk about the marketplace, and they think that they have to go online and do something. And Jason made this point, if they're not actually eligible for a subsidy, no one has to go online to get coverage, but that is the place where they can get those subsidies. And many people, particularly those who have large employer coverage, are not going to see significant changes to their coverage in 2014. The sea changes are happening in the small and individual markets, and there will generally be more expensive coverage in those markets for the reasons that we talked about earlier in the broadcast, that there is going to be greater access for people who were previously uninsured. There's going to be expanded coverage, and that generally drives costs up. For some people, their costs will come down because of the subsidies, or if they were previously very expensive because of their health conditions. And those are sort of some of the main changes. But many people will go into this next year and not notice any significant changes because they have their coverage through a large employer, and that large employer coverage isn't significantly changing in the new year. It really is going to affect people differently depending on how they currently have their coverage.
Very fine. That exhausts the questions from the audience and through social media. Does anyone on the panel care to make a final comment, a final observation? And if not, go ahead, Jason Stevenson.
We at UHPP and with our partners, we are involved in enrolling folks on healthcare.gov, and we have seen a market improvement in the website in the past couple weeks. So those who have had trouble signing up should go back, give it a second chance. The deadline is approaching December 23rd to sign up for coverage. That would start on January 1st. And just like you don't want to wait for your Christmas shopping to be at the last minute, you don't want to wait for your insurance shopping to be at the last minute either. So it's a good time to go online right now if you need assistance. TakeCareUtah.org or United Way 211 are two places you can find it.
And Greg Mattis will give you the final word. Can you run down? Maybe I'm putting you on the spot. Do you have the new deadlines burned in your brain?
Sure, absolutely. And Jason just hit one of the big ones. So it depends on what you want the coverage for. But if you want coverage for January 1st, it's December 23rd. You have until the end of March for this open enrollment period to go and shop and get coverage. And if you're trying to avoid the penalty, the reason you're getting coverage is you don't want to pay that tax penalty. You have until the end of that period, so the end of March, to actually sign up to avoid the tax penalty. And each of these deadlines is going to happen per month. So for the January deadline is December 23rd. There'll be a deadline during January for February coverage and during February for March coverage. If you want that coverage right now for January 1st, you have until December 23rd.
Okay, very fine. That wraps up the Healthcare Reform Forum presented by KPCW and the Intermountain Park City Medical Center. And I want to thank great co-sponsors as well, Wasatch Beers, Park City Municipal Corporation, which donated use of the great Santee facility here, and Pepsi helped provide some of the refreshments tonight. So thanks also to them and to Roger Crawford, who engineers our remotes as a volunteer over here in the dark. And also Cindy Bywater, Monica Goodner, and the rest of the great team at KPCW who were all involved in this program. Thanks very much for coming out or listening online or on air. And at this point, we will send it back to the studio and NPR News already in progress.